Hello and welcome to a special podcast to accompany the Lancet Global Health's second ever commission on global eye health. I'm the editor Zoe Mullen, and I'm joined today by the co-chairs of the commission, Professor Matthew Burton of the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine in the UK, and Professor Hannah Fahl of the University of Calabar in Nigeria. Welcome both. So commissions, for those unfamiliar with the format, are, as the Lancet journals define them at least, a scientific review, inquiry and response to an urgent and perhaps neglected or understudied health predicament. So Matthew, you actually approached us with this idea of a commission on global eye health. What made you consider that global eye health was ripe for a Lancet commission?
Back when we first met, I think it was early 2019, the time was coming towards the end of the Vision 2020 program, which has really shaped global eye health programs over the last decade, two decades, in fact. And we felt it was, as a community, a good time to take stock of where we'd got to, what had been achieved, and what needs to be done going forward. It was in the context of an awareness of increasing, not decreasing, numbers of people affected by vision impairment and other eye health issues globally. And that was in the face of a lot of additional work. And part of the issue is really around not only growing global populations, but also aging of global populations all around the world, because many of the problems that cause vision impairment are linked to being a bit older. And also a number of other major shifts in causes, particularly the increase in short-sightedness or myopia in Asian populations, had been driving a big change, a big increase in the number of people affected. So it was in that context that we felt as a group that it would be timely to take stock, think about where we've got to, and think about the coming decade and what needed to be done to address the growing need.
Absolutely. And so Matthew mentioned this Vision 2020 initiative, Hannah, which I know you were quite involved with. What was it? Can you tell us a little bit more about it and maybe what were some of its major achievements?
For eye health, there had been action throughout the world on vitamin A deficiency and onchocerciasis and so on. But certain things happened that encouraged the partners or people involved at the time to want to come together. And so it was an initiative of a partnership between the World Health Organization and the main international NGOs. And that was in February of 1999. So it was launched and called Vision 2020, The Right to Sight. And its goal was quite simple. Because of what we know now, we know the main causes, we have interventions that have been proven to work and are realistic. So it was time to put it all together in one goal of seeing that if can we eliminate avoidable causes of blindness by the year 2020, in 20 years' time. So that the main aim was that we would try to give all people throughout the world the right to sight.
Now, one of the key messages of the commission is a need to reframe eye health as a development issue, as well as a health issue, and cutting across several, in fact, a lot of the sustainable development goals. Matthew, do you want to expand on that a little?
So I guess, in approaching this, we want to propose a new, more holistic definition of what we mean by eye health. And in this commission, we call for an adoption of a new definition that refers to eye health as something that maximizes vision, so eyesight, ocular health, so how the eyes are generally, not just purely in terms of how well they see, but also in terms of functionability, and thereby an individual's ability to contribute to society in general, their overall health and well-being, social inclusion and quality of life. And we feel that vision and eye health really intersect with many, many aspects of life, not just health issues. So we undertook as a commission group a review of the published literature, looking for evidence which connects interventions done to improve eye health in a very broad range of areas, and how that impacts on specific targets related to individual sustainable development goals. And we found a moderate number of papers, a number of trials in particular, which provide really quite high quality evidence linking action to improve eye health and address vision impairment, leading to tangible improvements in other factors, such as, for example, education, ability to engage in the workplace, safety on roads. And so this really helps us to see vision in a much more holistic way, not just something that's just purely a health issue, but something that impacts on many aspects of life. So just to give you an example or two, ensuring that children who cannot see well because they got refractive error are identified early and are provided with glasses to wear, particularly during the school day, to enable their learning, has very direct impact on their academic attainment in life. And as you can imagine, that then has major implications for their life trajectory in terms of workplace engagement and so on. Another example is, as we get older, our ability to see near declines. So usually by the age of 40 or 50, people start noticing they can't focus near too. And that affects a lot of important tasks, not just reading, but other things as well. And there's a nice study conducted in India, which looked at giving people who have presbyopia, that near vision impairment, spectacles, asked the question whether that helped them to increase their ability to function in the workplace. And what that found was, in the particular paradigm that was being investigated, was people who are picking tea in northern India were actually having good near vision to spot the right leaves to pluck and choose, translated into actually improved quality of the choices that they were making around the types of leaves to pick, the amount that they were able to pick, and what they earned for that. So those are just two examples of how improving eye health intersects with education and the workplace.
Thanks. Yeah, that was a lovely study, actually, wasn't it? That was published in Lancet Global Health as well. One of my favourites. Hannah, a related key message is that eye care services should be included as an essential component of universal health coverage. So from the perspective of a low and middle income country, how realistic is that, do you think? And are there any example countries you can point to that have actually started to do this?
Well, the universal health coverage, the way we try to present it, is that on one side, we should try to cover the population and the area, so kind of geographical and population coverage. And the second part is the kind of services we offer, we can make that as full as possible. What we define as essential services, how do we expand that? And number three is that in many countries, particularly in the LMICs, people pay out of pocket. So the financial component of making services available to people. And I think that in the LMICs, we think that we can address those three. And the examples I have are that in extending coverage to populations and to areas, the community itself is a wealth, and that the person integrated care is seeing that person not just as a recipient, but as a contributor to their own health. So recognizing that even in an LMIC, the population itself is wealth of health. And I can give examples to that. The traditional systems exist. Community health workers exist. They've been used in the onchocerciasis program for the mass distribution of ivermectin. They are used in trachoma. And without that community participation, we would not have achieved as much as we do. And I think we can build on that. And in schools, they represent the future generation. So if we've got a good school health program, a good school eye health program, in which attitudes and knowledge and practices changed, even in an LMIC, we can make a lot of that. We have capture populations. Most of our people work in the market, work in the farms. they know about health. They have looked after their health for a while. And I say that the person, the family, is the first health provider, and they can be quite useful. Looking at the essential services going forward, the Commission has done the work to show that the integration is key, integration of eye health into anything we do, whether it's in the policy or in the finance or in the design of the service delivery. If eye health is seen as part of every system and every service delivery is designed not as a silo, not as an exclusive minor specialty, but adopting the whole person approach in anything that we do. And in the LMICs too, we have moved the use of our human resource into competency-based programs. So you can train somebody, middle health workers, to become cataract surgeons to address the leading cause of blindness, which is cataract. And the last bit, which we all fear, is the financial. How do we manage the finances so that the out-of-pocket expenses does not push our population into poverty? And there have been examples, for in India, where you have Aravind eye systems or the Prasad system, in which 50% is money collected and 50% is given free to patients. Innovative financing has been done. So if, again, integration is key, if we integrate the cost of eye health into the financing systems from the national government level down to the person selling paracetamol at the market, I think even in an LMIC, we should be able to change those three areas. One, the population; two, the geographical coverage; three, the types of services people can benefit from; and four, how do they actually access it and pay for it. And going forward, the social insurance schemes that would make sure that eye care is part and parcel of any financing for health, public or private.
And there's another component, in fact, to universal health coverage, which is, of course, quality. So one of our previous commissions, our first commission, was all about high quality health systems. So it's a much wider issue, obviously goes beyond eye health. But Matthew, maybe you can reflect on some of the specifics of that for eye health.
Absolutely. It's a really, really important issue. Just to give you an example, worldwide, I think there are somewhere in the region of about 25 million cataract operations performed each year. That, I think, is the second most frequent surgical procedure performed. So getting the quality of that work to the highest possible level has great implications for a very, very large number of people day in, day out around the world. So in the commission, we took a very holistic view of quality, not just what is the surgical outcome of a particular operation performed, but expanded it to not just only the effectiveness of the work that's being done, whether it's surgery or other aspects of care, but also thinking about the efficiency, the degree to which services are people-centered, their safety, their timeliness, equity, and how well they are integrated. And in addition to those seven, I think, WHO sort of dimensions of examining quality in health systems, we also added an eighth one, which is a look at planetary health, recognizing that healthcare is actually a major contributor globally to, for example, greenhouse gases. And so we wanted to take a look at what kind of impact eye healthcare specifically might be having as well alongside other things. So we've looked at this from a number of perspectives. One is looking at trying to get a better handle on data. So the commission analyzed available population-based data sets specifically around cataract, the coverage of cataract, but also the quality of the outcome of that cataract surgical service, an indicator that WHO is now using for global program monitoring called the Effective Cataract Surgical Coverage. And that was a very interesting in terms of trying to understand different regional effective cataract surgical coverage rates and what are some of the issues that are feeding into either reduced productivity or reduced surgical outcomes. We also looked at interventions and search literature for interventions that improved cataract surgical services, again, taking that broad view of those eight different dimensions of quality. And that was really helpful in terms of identifying things that seem to be improving quality in a number of different situations. And we hope that that will be really valuable to people in different health systems looking at trying to improve this. So in terms of sort of the big actions or conclusions that the commission would encourage programs to look at and to move forward on, this would be really to kind of take a holistic view around quality, to be systematically and thoughtfully governing for quality. So by that, we mean that the governance structures, the policies, the regulations, the accountability are set up to promote quality. A second area would be the design of the services, that they are designed in such a way that it maximizes the quality of care. Thirdly, as Hannah touched on earlier, is a key issue is how workforces are trained, and a shift towards much more competency-based training, strengthening the workforce, but also providing that enabling environment so they can actually apply those skills that they've learned, that they've become competent in their day-to-day practice by giving them the right tools, individuals the right tools to be able to deliver service. And then for the final thing is really looking at populations and trying to ignite that demand for quality from within the population, sharing information about quality so that people really engage with these aspects of service delivery and raise expectations, which we think will have a broad and positive impact as well on driving up quality.
Absolutely. And I think eye health is an area where a lot of technological advances and innovations have a great potential to expand quality services, particularly where perhaps these valuable human resources for health are in short supply. Can you tell us about some of these, Matthew?
There's a lot of interest currently in sharing eye health service tasks with people who are not specifically trained to exclusively just work in the eye health sector, and sharing those tasks, particularly with the primary healthcare workforce. And there are a number of ways that that becomes more realistic as some new developments, particularly around mHealth and around the potential exciting opportunities around the application of artificial intelligence in the context of eye health services, become more of a reality. There's a lot of research going on currently about how we can apply artificial intelligence to, for example, examine images collected of people's eyes in order to define whether someone has a potential problem and needs services, or whether they haven't got a problem and therefore don't need to access services. And there's a lot of work currently going on around validating those in different populations. And one of the things that the commission highlighted actually was through an analysis, a systematic review of available data sets, is that actually for many populations, we do not currently have really good image data sets in order to develop and validate those artificial intelligence algorithms. And that's an area that really does need a lot of joined up concerted work in order that populations that are less well served currently aren't left behind, which is, I think, a real danger. mHealth, particularly smartphone-based technology that allows people to be connected to services. So, for example, a primary healthcare worker identifies someone who's got an eye problem, it can facilitate the connection of that individual patient with a problem into the secondary care services and facilitate improved follow-up and ability to access services. So there's a lot of opportunity there to share tasks through the application of technology. Fast moving field.
So finally, I think it's fair to say that the commission has focused on avoidable blindness and vision impairment. But while recognising the rights of those with an existing visual disability to high quality integrated rehabilitative services. Can you expand on that a little bit, Hannah, maybe just to finish off?
Even before the commission, we've always talked about avoidable causes of blindness and addressed those. And science is very busy whittling at reducing what we mean by avoidable, so that in the future, all causes may become avoidable, and we really look forward to that. But the unavoidable causes of blindness, what the commission has done is to begin to look at blindness not as a person who is completely blind, but the recognition that at some point in life, you may lose vision, and that vision gets corrected, doesn't get corrected in time. So you may be living with blindness or visual impairment. And it's that expanded thinking is what is remarkable about the commission. The other thing that I find remarkable about what the commission has done, it's for us to look at another definition of vision, that we look at giving people maximized vision and also know that in eye health is not really always about vision. It could be about pain or redness, but in all of that, it limits your ability to work or relate or whatever. And the last bit which relates to this question is the term functional, the functional ability, connecting your visual loss to what you can do and how you can relate to people. So I think the commission has really shone a torchlight on how we look at visual loss and the person. And this relates and links up directly to the Sustainable Development Goals, in which they say that persons with disability play an important role in achieving the SDGs. I don't think one has really looked at what people with disability can bring to the table of development. And the commission has shone a torchlight on that as well. And for me, I think the benefits of doing it that way is that we are connecting disability to our discussions on quality of life, on well-being, and recognizing that there are two coins: the rehabilitative services to the person, the use of a white cane, the use of a laptop, those kind of development concern the person. And some work has been done on that. But more importantly, and that's where we'll be looking forward to, is the change of the society to include. The change in our infrastructure, the change in the way we look at people with disability, not with pity or things we can do for them, but things that they can do for us. And how do we need to change in our workplace, in our homes, in our environments to include? And that inclusion now shifts not just considering disability, but including all marginalized and all vulnerable groups. So more like an attitude and the recognition of the value that the disabled persons can bring. And I would like to recognize that value in that there is a term that the disabled use: nothing about us without us. We, the who are not disabled, cannot really step into their shoes. They have to teach us and show us how we need to change, and that is the value they bring to the table. And we have persons like Ambassador Webson, who is really leading in the advocacy of bringing eye health into development. We have a new president that who's also probably visually disabled, sharing that it also takes them time to come out, you know, the term coming out, to accept that they are disabled, to know what they can bring to the table of discussion. So I think the commission has played a major role in that term, the functional ability of a person, not focusing so much on the disability, but on the ability and what we, who have been blind to disability, can now become sighted to disability.
That's a lovely note to finish on. Thank you very much, Matthew, Hannah, for joining me today, and congratulations on this massive and impressive and inspiring piece of work. So thank you very much.